You are listening to 15 Minutes, the show with Osiris Munir, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, hi. I felt like doing Eddie Murphy when Eddie Murphy does. Welcome to the neighborhood. He goes, hi. Hi, everybody out there. Welcome back to 15 Minutes of Show and LA Talk Radio Live. It is I, in person, in spirit, in the flesh, Osiris, with 15 Minutes of Show. So what's going out there? It is way, way too much going on out there for me to handle. So I'm going to try to handle just right in front of me. So today, I wanted to kind of skip into a topic before we bring our very special guest on. So I wanted to talk about race relations and racial things and people having differences of opinion. I've never understood that. Maybe when I was kind of unenlightened, I understood a little bit more about that. But all I can say about that is that I do believe that people that hate other people ultimately hate themselves. I mean, how do you hate people you don't even know? I mean, think about it. Brain goes off. How do you hate people you don't know? And then I do believe that in the coming, not in the coming, but in the times we're living in now, people that think like that, people that are limited, people that can't get outside of their own skin, they can't get outside their own brain, they don't know how to flex enough, they're not using even a little bit of the brain, they're not even using a quarter, the P part of the brain. They're just kind of animalistic in behavior. Those people will cease to exist. They're going to eventually burn out. Nobody wants to hear all of that right now. We have too many other problems to be trying to go back and slide back into some old mode of thinking when everything in our lives is asking us to push forward. So that's what I have to say about that. Okay. So I did something special. Drum roll. We have a very special guest today. He's a friend of mine. I've known him for a long time, seen him grow into coming from already being famous to now super celebrado. So I'm going to say the first part of his introduction in Spanish, just so I can talk Spanish. And I practiced last night and this morning just for him. So, hoy tengo el maravilloso placer de presentaris al padrino de la salsa romántica, La Palabra, desde Colombia. Bienvenidos! Yeah! Now I want to talk English again. Hey, Palabra.
You did great.
Thank you.
You did great. Wow. That was great.
Thank you. So what's happening? ¿Qué pasado contigo hoy?
Well, you know, everything is moving in the right direction. It was just when you first opened the show, You didn't mention about race relation. And it's such a natural thing in the U.S. to talk about race because it happens, but then when you move away, it's not in your face like that, you know? It's really amazing.
And we're going to talk about that because one of the first questions I want to bring up now, for those of you out there who don't know who La Palabra is, La Palabra in Espanol means the word. And like I said, when I introduced him, he is the El Padrino de la Salsa de la Romántica Musica. So before Mark Antony, before all of these people came to be known for Salsa Romántica Musica, La Palabra was well into, had birthed it, breathed it, made it happen, and brought it to life. So we're going to talk about first the incident in New York in 1987, and it made the headlines of the New York Times. I believe it said something like, Black Cubans apart in two worlds. And you're Cuban and you're Black. So I want to hear your take on that. What was going on in New York and the world at that time so you can bring everybody up to date?
Well, the article was done in the New York Times, but the incident took place in Georgia, in Attica. And it's a jail called Attica. Mm-hmm. Right. And the incident was that in the 80s, a lot of Cubans left the island and they were put in jail and they were waiting for sponsors to you know, take them out and help them start a new life. But the Black Cubans were not getting any sponsors. So they got to a point where they just couldn't take it anymore. And they riot. They made one of the biggest riots in the jail in Georgia. And it was so big that it got national attention. So what happened is the New York Times went and started investigating about the situation in Georgia. And they also ended up in Miami because that's where most people were being sponsors from, but Black Cubans were not getting any sponsors. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know who told them about me because in those days I was already frustrated with the Miami lifestyle and the racial situation I was going through. But they knocked at my door and they said, "This is the New York Times. We came to interview you," just like that.
Wow.
So when they started asking me questions, that was exactly the subject. How was I being treated in Miami as a Black Cuban? So my question was, my answer was, I have never been so discriminated in my life until I arrived in Miami. That's how that happened.
So now, how did you get into the U.S.? What got your drive working and your mojo working to come to the U.S.? What led you here from Panama? Was it from Panama? Panama.
No, Cuba.
Oh, you're from Guantanamo. Cuba. Okay.
Guantanamo.
Okay. So what?
Well, it wasn't my decision. I was only 15. And my mom had married a naval Marine from the U.S. So that gave her the opportunity to take the family out on a visa. So I just had to follow along. You know, it wasn't like I said, "Oh, I want to go to the U.S. You know, the decision was made for me. Mm-hmm. So I left Cuba when I was 15 years old. And in those days, if you were 15 or over 65, you could leave the country. But anything in between, you could not leave the country.
Oh, wow.
So I barely made it in those days. And, yeah, my family left with my grandmother, my sister. You know, the close part of my family, we left Cuba in 1966.
Mm-hmm. And what happened? And, I mean, what was going on in Cuba for you guys to want to leave? It wasn't some wonderful life. What was going on over there to make your mom want to have to pack up and get a visa? And come to
well,
the US?
You know, a lot of situation was going on. Like I said, I did not leave because of any political
reason.
Situation, mm-hmm. not me. Mm-hmm. But what happened is after Castro took over, mm-hmm. There was beginning to be problem with the United States. Mm-hmm. And he intervened some companies that were Americans. And Castro was very defiant to the Americans' control that they had in Cuba. Mm. Now, that's what happens. The U.S. used to mandate almost everything in Cuba. As a matter of fact, they had something called the Platt Amendment, which gave the United States the right to invade Cuba anytime they felt it was necessary. So the Platt Amendment was eventually abolished, but the power of the U.S. was still in Cuba. I mean, you know, they control everything. So when Castro took over, his mindset was liberate Cuba from the United States clause, like they say, you know. And that started a lot of problems because many Cubans that, like the United States, felt that Cuba was not heading in the right direction. Mm-hmm. So that's what prompted a lot of Cubans to start mm-hmm. migrating to the United States. My father migrated to New York, and my mother migrated to New York also.
Okay.
But it was more like a political thing because Castro was really... the first revolutionary in Latin America, mm-hmm. and the United States was afraid that his mindset could spread to other Latin countries. So since the 60s, the United States has imposed economic blockade in Cuba, mm-hmm. and Cuba has been suffering for over 60 years.
I see not a lot of people understand that. And to be honest with you, when you said that, all I could see was the scene in Scarface when Al Pacino and the other guy were in there and they were in prison and they had just come over from the boat and they started going through and saying, La Libertad, La Libertad. And remember, he started stabbing the guy in the chest or something like that. And, you know, the fact that all of that political tension was there. And there's always a way that people find to get out of a situation. Your mom led you out of that into New York. Now, how did music, how did La Palabra, how did, what your name is Fito, what is your real name? Fito?
Palabra. Palabra. Yeah. La Palabra.
La Palabra. So how did you get the name La Palabra? Who did they name you La Palabra? Did you become La Palabra? I feel like it's something you became. You became La Palabra, the word.
Well, I did become La Palabra once I changed my name. It mm-hmm. took a few years, mm-hmm. but the incident took place in California, mm-hmm. where I was performing in a club called Candilejas. And during the intermission, I was so tired. Yes, I used to give it all on stage.
Yeah,
that's one of the things I try to do all the time. Yeah. So I sat down in a table. They didn't have a place where the artists can relax. Yeah. So I was out sitting down, and a guy comes to me and says, "Hey, that guy over there wants to meet you." So I got up. I went to his table, and he says to me, he stands up and he says, "My name is La Palabra." So I say, "La Palabra?" So he repeated the name, but it wasn't La Palabra. It was another name. But I understood La Palabra so clearly that when I left the club that night, it was spinning in my mind, mm-hmm. La Palabra. And the more it spinned, I liked the name, and I adopted the name La Palabra.
That's nice. Now, you were also, were you a musician back in Cuba? Or did you become a musician over in the United States? Because I know in your bio, you went to school at Cooley High. You that was a whole group of people, and they were all, I mean, everybody knows about Cooley High. Come on, if you don't know what Cooley High, go look it up. Go look it up. You were in this group of people that were kind of destined to move into entertainment, and I believe you came to California because of Stevie Wonder or something like that. What happened? Let us know how. What happened to take you out of New York and lead you into the path of now you're a badass?
Well, to answer your first part, my grandmother taught me the piano. Mm. And I became like a favorite in Caimanera, which is a little town, like a village town near the ocean.
Mm-hmm. And so
I was playing the piano. My grandmother taught me. And there was a time where they were having a contest with two bands, mm-hmm. and they were all professional musicians, but they needed a piano player. So somebody said, "Oh, it's a little boy playing the piano over there.
How old
were
you?
Come in and,
how old
and
were
do
you?
The piano." I was 11.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. No, I was 13. I started playing at 11. I was 13 when that happened. Mm-hmm. So they went and got me. I practiced with the band. And when I got on stage, I could not sit still in that piano, and the audience went crazy with me, the way I was moving and everything. So my band won the contest because every time they put the hand over my head, the crowd went wild.
Ah.
So that day, it was the beginning of me feeling like a star. You know, it was the first time I was in front of an audience,
yeah.
And they loved me. So at the age of 13, that was my first experience to wake up that inner musician that I had, mm-hmm. that began to grow, you know? So that's at that time, my mom already had left Cuba. So we were packing our stuff, and the government, since I won the prize, they wanted me to go to a special school. Mm-hmm. But my grandmother refused, because if I went to that school, that meant I could not leave Cuba. Oh. So we kind of waited it out, and 2-3 years later, we left Cuba. But my first step in the United States of America, my very first step was a very weird experience. That what happened is we landed in Miami, mm-hmm. and everybody was so joyful and, you know, screaming. And they, you know, they felt like they were free now. Mm-hmm. So I was looking through the window, and I saw everybody boarding and boarding, getting off the airplane.
Okay.
And, you know, there were so many newspapers and photographers in lined up taking pictures. And, you know, I already felt like a little star. So I was dying to get out there and take my, have my picture taken, you know.
Yeah.
So I'm looking down and through the window and, oh, my God, it was a frenzy. So when it's time for my family to come out, I was the first one at the gate. And I start going down the stairs. And the minute I put my feet on the ground, it was like a tunnel, a dark tunnel. And it was very eerie to be walking in this dark situation when before there was so many pictures and so many things going on. So as I left that area and I looked back, they were taking pictures all over again. So what had happened, they did not take pictures of us because we were black.
Oh,
that's what happened. So they were taking pictures of everybody except when we showed up, no pictures.
Not that it's funny, but the way, the way you said it, you said, look, all of a sudden, he saw lights and cameras. My man saw lights, stars, action. Then all of a sudden was a dark tunnel. Like, where'd the lights go? What happened?
I'm not exaggerating. That's exactly how it was. Nobody took a picture.
That's so sad.
Nobody. Yeah.
And I think it's sad, again, going back to race relations, if I talk to you some more, that's sad. You are really limiting an experience. That's a human experience. I mean, I got to learn so much from being in the military and from hanging around with other cultures and learning everything from how they eat, how they cook their food, how they worship and everything, and having those experiences and bringing them back to my own culture and enhancing the beauty of my own culture by being able to be open to other people. So when you got off the plane, were you there for a reason? Were you going into the airport because you had to perform somewhere? You were with a band. And I want to know how you went from a single musician to orchestra. Your orchestra. You know, it's the orquesta, la palabra. So how did you get that big? I mean, where did the other youths come from?
The situation in the airplane had nothing to do with music.
Oh.
It was Cubans leaving the island. That was it.
So they were singing.
It was called the Freedom Flight.
Mm.
But I had stars in my eyes from the experience I had with the band when I played. But nobody there was a musician. Everybody was just families that were getting off the airplane first time in the United States.
Uh-huh.
And that's what happened. So I landed, and from there we went to New York City.
Mm-hmm.
New York City was a very exciting city, like it still is.
Yeah.
But you got to remember, when I got there in 1966, they had the racial situation was wild.
Mm-hmm.
Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, the hippies were all the way, you know, they were trying to live their lifestyle.
Freaking.
The Vietnam War was going. So all those things were all part of the society that I came into when I came to the United States. Mm-hmm. So it was hard to adjust because in Cuba, I was on the Vietnamese side. Now I'm in the United States, which is the other side of Vietnam. I'm like, this is weird. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh. So
I had to digest the racial situation, the hippie situation, and the Vietnam War, because they used to have demonstrations, very violent demonstrations against the war.
That's right.
When I first landed in New York City. And the same thing that happened to me in New York, in Cuba, happened to me in New York. When I got to New York, my mother bought a piano and I was playing the piano. And there was a group of professional musicians. Mm-hmm. They were called the New Yorican Sectet. This was all professional
New
guys.
New Yorican Sectet? Uh-huh. Go ahead.
Yeah. The New York Sectet. The New Yorkina in Spanish.
Yeah.
So they needed a piano player. So somebody said, oh, there's a little boy in Brooklyn.
They can play the piano.
They can play the piano. So at the age of 15, I joined that band. And I was playing all over the clubs in New York City at that age. And I was living in New York to the most, really. For being 15 years old, I was around musicians. I was really having a blast in New York.
I can feel it. I feel the energy, because when you're talking about it, it's like your body's sending out these energy pieces. And if you're sensitive, you can feel it. So it's like I went back and I felt you being the young teenage with stars in their eyes, and you know, the first time in the U.S. and all these badass musicians, and you're coming into your own. I mean, come on, man. That is the height of being a teen and what you went through. But what I want to find out, how did you become the al padrino de la salsa romántica music? Because I know that they've always given credit to, I don't have anything against Mark Anthony or anybody, but you guys know, no matter how long people may think they can get away with things, the truth always comes to light. So if any of you out there really know the truth, I'd suggest as you get older and your soul comes to call for you to, you know, to bare your soul and tell the truth, tell the truth. If you know the truth, tell the truth. This man, I've seen what he composed. I've seen what he did when I first met him, and he has proof that he is the first, the one and only Al Padrino de Salsa Romántica. So tell us what happened, Palabra.
Well, you know, it was a process. For example, when I was in New York, I was absorbing the blues in Harlem. You know, Harlem was bustling in those days, and there was a lot of nightclubs and jazz. And my father took me to the Apollo Theater. That was the first time I saw James Brown and the Miracles. Yeah. And I was like, wow, how come I never heard these guys in Cuba? Because all you ever heard was Elvis Presley, all these other guys, and Nat King Cole, and a little bit of Ray Charles, but you never heard raw soul like Wilson Pickett, James Brown, the Miracles, the Temptations. I never heard of them. So I was in the Apollo Theater, and I was like taken back by the experience. Well, that experience, and musically, when I moved to Detroit, because I only lived in New York 1 year, because my mom decides to leave New York and go to Detroit, and I cry like a baby because I was just beginning to let loose, because I was in a lot of pain when it comes to learning a new society and living in Cuba, you know?
Yes.
So 1 year I lived in New York City. My mom decided to go to Detroit. And what was the welcome committee in New York, in Detroit, when we got there? Mm-hmm. It was the biggest riot in the United States of America.
What were they rioting about? The same thing? What was the
1968,
riot?
1968. The biggest riot in the United States. And I land in Detroit in the middle of the riot.
The riot. Wow.
We had to go home, like, you know, when you're ducking bullets in the car, and we go. That's how we were driving to get home.
Unfortunately,
the National Guard was all over the place.
Yeah,
and we were like, I mean, you imagine being confused. I was confused already in New York, but to see this now in the U.S., it was us. It was really, I didn't know what to say. I didn't know what to do. So we finally made it home. We couldn't get out. We couldn't go out anymore, and I live in Detroit. Detroit was so different from New York City. New York City had a Latin community. It had, you know, the Jewish, the Italian. Mm-hmm. And you didn't mingle with everybody, but that's New York. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But when you go to Detroit, it became a very segregated place. Mm-hmm. I remember streets, like for example, 12th Street, which is where Motown used to be.
Okay.
You know, 12th Street and I forgot the other name. That area was the black area. Then from 12th Street up, it was the white area. I never seen that before in my life. Hmm. And then after the riots, whites moved up and then blacks keep moving up and whites keep moving up and blacks keep moving.
Moving out.
I lived that. I saw street by street how blacks kept going forward and then blacks go, white people could go backward and they were, you know, backing up and black people kept taking over certain neighborhoods. So it was really, my mom wasn't thinking of racial situation.
No.
So when she bought a house, she buys it in a white area, right? And we don't know. I mean, you know, we just...
Ouch. Ouch.
So when we got there, I mean, nobody gave us a welcome, you know, nothing. You know, but we didn't know anything. But I tell you, where we live, in about 2 years later, it was all black. All black neighborhood. When I got to Detroit, they began busing kids. So to answer your question about Salsa Romantica, that experience that I was having in Detroit, and then when I started going to school, it opened my mind to American music. Mm. I mean, in those days, the American system had the best school program in the world. I'm not kidding. High school was like, you could study anything in music, orchestra, choir, and ensemble, big band. I mean, I don't know. There was one senator that took the music program out of schools. Mm-hmm. I forgot his name. I don't know why they allowed one senator to do that. Mm-hmm. But the United States had the best music program ever. That was one of the best things of the United States. So they took it, you know, when I went to school, I enjoyed that. I really took that in. So mm-hmm. I began to learn arrangements, but I began to listen to a lot of Count Basie and Duke Ellington.
Yeah.
And I would go back as far as Bessie Smith, because I'm very much into American culture and the jazz. So I'm like an American in the sense that I can go back in history mm-hmm. because I listen to Cap Galloway, you know, all those guys, and Glenn Miller, all those guys. So I learned to about the big band sound. So little by little, when I was playing now with my band in Detroit, Latin music, I began to do arrangement, but it was influenced by the big band sound. And one of the things that the American composers that do jazz, and I'm not the only one that's going to say this, but mm-hmm. they say that less is more in American music.
What do you mean by that?
I believe in that. It's sometimes you get an arranger, and let's say he studied classical music, but when he does the arrangement, the horn parts do not let the singer breathe. Oh. So the singer is singing, and the horns are bah, bah, playing. And when you listen to jazz musician doing a solo, American black jazz horn players, they are more like para pow, pa 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 pa. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do.
But if you listen to a lot of Latinos that do jazz, they get too intricate. It's like they miss the boat when it comes to the jazz and having that. Less is more. And that's the soul part. And that's what made jazz so different in the 50s and 60s, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I learned that style. When I was in Detroit that I began to play more American music, there was a group that had a hit called Brainstorm. And I don't know if you ever heard of Brainstorm, but Brainstorm, they went all the way to that show Soul Train and everything.
Yeah.
Brains. So I was, as a matter of fact, Belita Woods, the singer of that group, ended up with Parliament and the Funkadelic.
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, one of the things that I need to say to your audience is that in my career, I shared the stage with Michael Jackson.
Uh-huh.
I also played for Kobe Bryant's birthday party.
All right, now.
I played in the house of Will Smith for a baby shower. Mm-hmm. I also played for a private party for Sandra Bullock and Demi Moore, and everybody was there, Brad Pitt, everybody was there. I also played for a private party for President Clinton. So, and this is just to mention, you remember the guy that made a song called The Boat Wiggle?
The Boat Wiggle?
Yeah, it was like...
No, how does it go?
Bird,
How does it go?
The old song from the South. I played with him too. I mean, I met in my career, I began to meet so many musicians that when I moved to, when I began to play in Detroit with Brainstorm, it was so exciting. It was the days that a band was like Orwin and Fire. It was self-contained. Because, you know, the bands before, they were more like the Temptations, the Miracles. But then when bands like Orwin and Fire and then they came on, they were the entertainers. They were the musicians at the same time. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's what made the 70s so different. So all the bands were singers and they play an instrument and they did the show. See? So that's what became in the 70s. And I enjoyed playing with Brainstorm until the group got dropped by CBS. So I was playing in another club and this guy says, hey, I love the way you play the piano. We're doing a project with Stevie Wonder and we'd like you to be part of it. No. So I go, oh man, come on, man. I mean, I used to play with the Dramatics. I used to play with the brother of the Dramatics. They had a group called the Five Special.
Uh-huh.
You know, and
I've heard of this
up and coming groups.
Yeah.
But you know, they never went too far. The Dramatics did, but not the other groups. So I say, oh man, you know. As a matter of fact, I was playing with Norma Jean Bell, was a sax player that used to play with the Rolling Stones.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I was pretty hooked up with the music scene in Detroit. So when they told me about Stevie Wonder, I didn't believe it. So I go, so they told me, listen, come over and we're going to call him and you can talk to him. I said, okay. So I went to the house. So they called Stevie Wonder and I talked to Stevie. And he said, hi, my name is Stevie, blah, blah, blah. I heard you're a good piano player. I'd like to get you into this project. Send me a demo so I can listen to the way you play. So I sent him a demo and he loved the way I played. So I became a part of that project called Phoenix Rising.
Yes.
And with Stevie Wonder, that's how I ended up going to Los Angeles, California. Oh my God, landed in California from Detroit.
It was like a whole kind of like a different
because
kind of planet.
I lived in Detroit that was very successful.
Uh-huh.
And after the riots, it began to dry it up. It was like they made an economic embargo on the city of Detroit and it just collapsed. And I could see blocks by blocks, the businesses leaving. I mean, I lived that experience in Detroit.
Uh-huh.
So Detroit is the way it is, but it's people think it's because racial, it's more than that. It was almost done on purpose after the riots. They sucked it up.
Well, wasn't
so when I moved from Detroit to LA, the streets were in Spanish, the houses were colorful, the greenery, I used to love to go by Beverly Hills. I mean, I was...
It made you feel special.
I was in cloud nine, like they say.
Yeah, like, wow.
I really enjoyed Los Angeles, and I still do.
Yeah.
And I was in between all the big musicians, like Rick James, because I was with Stevie Wonder.
Yeah.
So they used to go to the studio. Rick James, guys from Orwin and Fire. I mean, you name it.
Yeah.
I used to see them in LA. So my career was really, I felt very happy. But the problem with Stevie is that he was doing so many things that you had to sit and wait for him to have time for you.
Time to get, yeah.
So why? Because he was trying to get the Martin Luther King holiday and he used to go marching. I mean, people forget how united Black America used to be.
Used, I mean, to be, honestly. Keyword used to be.
I mean, I remember. Mm-hmm. And they used to, I mean, he used to march for the holiday of Martin Luther King.
Yeah, yeah.
So time kept passing. So I remember we had a meeting and I said to Stevie, I don't mind waiting, but could you please tell us like how long we're gonna be waiting for you to get this project off the ground? He said, no. When I come back from Japan, we're gonna go into the studio. Mm-hmm. And that's what we did. He came back, we went into the studio one time, and that was it. We had to sit and wait again. So we were waiting. In the meantime, I started mingling in the Latin music scene, you know? Mm-hmm. So I started going to the salsa club, and I began to meet musicians. So once I met a musician, his name was Yanni Nelson, and he asked me to come and stay and play the piano, and they loved the way I played the piano. And there were a couple of guys that were starting out a band called Versailles Orchestra. So they loved the way I played the piano, and they told me, hey, why don't you come with us and let's make this band together? And that's how I began to get involved in salsa, even though I was with Stevie Wonder, see? So when that group started, even though the group took off, I mean, in Sunset, mm-hmm. I don't know if you remember that section where they had, it's still there, but it's not like it used to be in the 80s.
What?
Where the rock bands used to play. Remember the Troubadour?
I remember the Troubadour.
Rock clubs that were on Sunset Boulevard.
The Whiskey, the Troubadour.
There you go.
The Whiskey is still there. Work.
I mean, that was the scene in Los Angeles.
Yeah,
and Candelaria was like a few miles down that strip. Well, when you passed my club, it was just like being at the Whiskey A Go, one of those places.
Yeah.
The line of people to come in to see the salsa band Versailles Orchestra. So we were a hit in L.A.
The Rainbow was a big popular club on Sunset.
Oh, yeah. I mean, everybody L.A., I mean, yeah. I'm telling you, I live the L.A. that many people wish they lived because I enjoyed that time. But I began to be more into the salsa scene. Mm-hmm. And in that club, I began to do ballads because I used to listen to American ballads. For example, ICK's, when I was in Detroit, all these other artists, Barry White, you know, they used to talk.
Yeah.
And I, you know, when ICK's came out, he was like the thing.
He was deep.
ICK's.
Something new.
He used to have the longest intro ever.
You know, he had to talk to the girls. You know, he had to do the sex. Talk to the girls.
And I'm talking about on a record. I don't mean live. On a record.
I met him in person. Yeah.
Hello. You know?
Yeah.
So I grew up in that environment.
Yeah.
And when I started doing my salsa romantica, which wasn't called that, I didn't have a name for it. Okay. The name came later.
Oh, okay.
What I started to do was taking the pop songs, the ballads, and putting it in the rhythm of Cuban music. Mm-hmm. But not just any pop ballad. It was the ones that were a hit, the ones that were being played on the radio. For example, when Kenny Rogers had Lady, I made Lady in salsa.
Uh-huh.
And you could hear Lady with Kenny Rogers, you could hear my version. So it was, that's what I was doing. And that's what led to what we have now as salsa romantica, because I was doing all those ballads in the Latin beat, especially Cuban rhythms. Mm-hmm. And I did so many of them. And, you know, I got to tell a little story now that I'm talking about Lady.
We're almost close to closing time, so I want to hear it. So go.
Yeah. Go. I was in a dinner, a Grammy from the Grammys, and Lionel Richie was leaning against a post by himself. Mm-hmm. And I already had done Lady, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't know if he knew that. So I saw him by himself. I go, let me introduce myself to Lionel. So I walked over to Lionel and said, hi, Lionel, my name is La Palabra. He goes, La Palabra.
Uh-oh.
So I go, I'm shocked. He goes, man, let me tell you how I know your name.
Your lady.
So he says to me, listen, man, I was in a tour in Italy. Like now, your song is a hit here in Italy, but it's not your version. Is this guy called La Palabra? So he says to me, that's why I know your name.
And you know, he's kind of picky about who does his songs, too. He's kind of picky about who tries to remake his song.
And he was very excited to meet me and everything. And I have seen him a couple of times after that. Mm-hmm. But Lady became, if you look at in Wikipedia of Lionel Richie, my name is in his Wikipedia.
Uh-oh.
Because Lady was such a big hit internationally. My version of Lady was really popular.
Skyrocket.
In France, in Europe, all over. And I tell you, even in Beijing, I went to Beijing in 2008.
I remember, yeah.
And I went, I went with an American group for the Olympics. And we were playing for about 4 months. We only had 2 weeks left. Mm-hmm. And somebody comes to the club, to the hotel, and they say, are you La Palabra? This is in China.
Wow.
And they said, do you want to stay? I didn't know that the work visa, you couldn't stay after your work visa expired.
Oh.
I said, yeah, I want to stay. I stayed in China 6 months.
Wow. So they made it possible for you to stay
because
there.
Because the song Lady, it's very popular in China.
I've heard it's popular all over the world, but listen, we got to go. I love to talk, you know, and I like people to come on the show that like to talk. So it really has been exciting having Palabra. What are your social media tags so that everybody can reach out and find you so you can hear L2Tune? And ladies, he is so sexy when he says lady.
Yeah, they can see
and he drops
lady.
His voice. Say, do one bar. Do one bar. Just go a bar.
Okay. Lady. I'm your knight and shiny armor, and I love you. You have made me what I am, and I am yours.
I tell you, we got to go. But listen, what social media? Tell us again. Tell us again your social media so they can reach out. We can reach
out. Okay, they can find me in the social media under Orquesta La Palabra.
Orquesta La Palabra.
L-O-D-R-A.
Okay. And then you also can look up L2Tune or any of those things and get him. So we're going to go. Yeah, don't forget about me. 15 minutes to show.
Orquesta La Palabra Facebook, Instagram, everything.
Okay. Orquesta La Palabra. We got to go. Don't forget about me. 15 great. Minutes to show. Palabra, bye, it was nice. Great seeing you and having you on the show. And we'll talk more behind the scenes and I'll have you back. Okay. Don't forget about me. 15 minutes to show. LA Talk Radio Live, your girl. ExpressAndAbstract.net and OnkEntertainment1.net. And I'll see you next week on LA Talk Radio Live. Bye. Have a good one. Don't forget, a smile works wonders. Bye-bye.
15 Minutes, the show with Osiris Munir, only on LA Talk Radio.